Royal Queen Seeds Interviews.
Welcome to another episode of the Royal Queen Seed Interviews. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking to Martin Lee, the co-founder and director of Project CBD, a non-profit that promotes research into CBD and its medical use. Martin is also a prolific writer, and his most recent book is called Smoke Signals, A Social History of Marijuana. His writing has been featured in many publications like The Washington Post, Harper's Magazine, Rolling Stones, and many more. Lee is also the co-founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. This was created in 1986 to eliminate corporate and establishment media bias. Welcome, Martin. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Happy to be with you.
How are you today? Are you having a good day?
Well, it's very early in the morning where I am, so yeah. We're just starting, but I'm looking forward to a good day.
Perfect. So today we're going to ask your expertise in all things CBD, and we have some questions for you. So I'm going to start with the first one, which is, what are the benefits of cannabinoids for our brain? Is there any difference between THC and CBD in this regard?
Interestingly, there was some research done and a paper, science paper, published in 1998 that examined both CBD and THC, cannabidiol and tetrahydrocannabinol, for its neuroprotective and antioxidant properties. And it was concluded on the basis of this research, and this was conducted incidentally by four scientists who are funded by the U.S. government, including a Nobel Prize winning scientist.
Yeah.
It concluded that both THC and CBD were powerful neuroprotectants and antioxidants, meaning they actually protected the brain against degeneration and other insults. And this research became the basis for a patent that the U.S. government took out on the neuroprotective and antioxidant properties of cannabinoids.
Yeah.
And they were referring to the plant cannabinoids, specifically THC and CBD. I should point out that this patent has been somewhat misleadingly represented by the CBD industry, which typically refers to it as a patent on CBD. That's not the case. It was a patent on cannabinoids.
Yeah.
On the basis of research conducted into both CBD and THC. So there you have it from the highest authorities in the U.S. government in terms of the medical establishment, understanding that these particular compounds from the cannabis plant are actually very good for the brain, that they can that would be protective against all sorts of neurodegenerative diseases, and specifically mentioned were Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, and so forth, basically protective against dementia. And what's interesting is that this research conducted by modern science actually confers and validates the ancient wisdom going back to China 5,000 years earlier, where cannabis was part of the medical pharmacopoeia in China. It was considered one of the supreme elixirs of immortality. That doesn't mean if someone took cannabis, they'd live forever. But it was understood in ancient China that cannabis conferred longevity, that it would protect against dementia. And this is explicitly stated in the ancient Chinese medical texts. So that there is a convergence of modern science and ancient wisdom. And I'm actually very comfortable with that. I think that's a good indication that there's something really going on here. So contrary to a lot of scare stories about marijuana harming the brain and all this, it's actually quite the opposite. That's not to say, one can smoke or take as much as they want and it'll always be good for you. But it's not harmful to the brain in a way, for example, that alcohol might be harmful to the liver. It doesn't degenerate brain cells. Quite the contrary, the researchers have found is that CBD and THC are both what scientists refer to as neurogenic compounds, meaning they actually stimulate the creation of new brain cells in adults. This is something that happens since we were born, actually when the child's brain is being formed in the womb, there's obviously a lot of neurogenesis, meaning formation of new cells, and because the brain is forming. And this process slows down considerably after birth, but it actually continues to some degree throughout one's lifetime. When one reaches old age, it could slow down considerably. And when there's a slowdown of neurogenesis, that is associated with clinical depression.
Yeah.
So CBD and THC have antidepressant properties in part because they stimulate the creation of new brain cells in a particular part of the brain called the hippocampus. Again, yeah. Now this is not, you know, far-flung stoner mythology. This is real science that has been, that is not controversial within the scientific community. This is well understood. Unfortunately, what happens in the scientific world often stays just among scientists, and it doesn't get out to the general public. So we still have a lot of myths about reefer madness and about the harm of marijuana that continues to burden us culturally.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Martin. That was extremely insightful. And the second question that we have for you is, what are the main compounds in cannabis that can help to treat addictive behaviors, trauma, and clinical depression?
All those three conditions, trauma, clinical depression, and addictive behaviors, that is also tied into a lack of neurogenesis or a lack in a particular part of the brain, this part of the brain called the hippocampus.
And yeah.
When it's not functioning properly, it can be associated with these diseases, particularly alcoholism and so forth. What's interesting is those three conditions in early research into psychedelic drugs, particularly LSD going back to the 1950s, showed promise for trauma, addiction, and substance abuse, depression, I should say. And there's a reason for that, is that the what scientists refer to as the endocannabinoid system, which CBD and THC interacts with, regulates a process. Physiological processes that are implicated in all those conditions. And the psychedelic drugs work in part through that same condition. So, you know, I mean, addiction is very, very complicated and complex and difficult. One area that's been of interest recently to scientists and medical researchers with respect to CBD and addiction in particular has to do with CBD's ability to kind of modify one's memory, environmental memory. What I mean by that, you know, if one is involved with an addictive substance, and let's say you go to rehab, and you come out and you're clean, but you go back into the same exact situation, the same environment, the same setting you were in which the addiction took root. What CBD seems to do, at least according to animal studies, it breaks the connection, the memory of the addiction with that place. So it has an anti-addictive property in that sense. And there's been quite a bit of animal research, preclinical research on cocaine addiction and methamphetamine, alcohol, of course, and even for, let's say, habitual marijuana use. So that that's a whole other discussion, that because some of the research there is really kind of crazy, but which shows that CBD would be helpful. But again, this research has been primarily focused on animals, and you can't necessarily jump from animal studies to people and assume that the same things will happen. But I think from what we hear anecdotally from people themselves, at Project CBD, the organization that I work with is an educational platform. We get a lot of reports that CBD is helpful for addictive situations. You know, obviously, opiate addiction is a major problem. And for that, it's not just CBD. THC could be helpful as well, because if you're dealing with opiate addiction, it very possibly started with a pain syndrome. You took opiates because you were prescribed it by your doctor to deal with pain. Unfortunately, opiates don't really deal with chronic pain very well. And you can get into a very vicious cycle where you're taking more and more, et cetera, overdose deaths. And I think this is another area where cannabinoids like CBD and THC can be helpful, because what we understand to be the case is that when THC is combined with opiates, it lowers the amount of opiates one needs to get the same results in terms of the painkilling properties.
Yeah.
So if you could take something with your opiate regimen that would reduce the necessary dose of the opiates and yet still deliver the same effect, that will lower the odds, lower the likelihood of a fatal overdose. And that's a very positive thing, you know, in and of itself. There's actually a considerable amount of research. We've published some of it on projectcbd.org that addresses cannabis and the opiate question. Cannabis combined with opiates does have this effect of lowering the amount of opiates needed for analgesia or for pain killing. So, you know, that's just the, I should say, the tip of the iceberg when it comes to addiction and cannabinoids. You mentioned depression and also trauma.
Yeah.
Again, these conditions we could talk about for hours, frankly, and each one alone, but they're also related. Typically, if you're dealing with a PTSD, oftentimes you're also dealing with depression. It's a PTSD is a depressing condition to have to deal with. We know from soldiers returning from combat zones, suffering from these terrible memories of what they saw, what they did, what they experienced, that going back even to Vietnam War days, the soldiers came back, they're smoking weed, and they say that's the only thing that helped. That the drugs they were given, the pharmaceuticals they were given by the Veterans Administration doctors, it didn't really help very much. If anything, they were themselves, they were also addicted to these drugs. But a few puffs of weed seemed to, send the trauma into remission, at least temporarily. So
yeah,
there's been a good amount of research going on, focusing on trauma and cannabinoids. And one example of a study I found quite fascinating that underscores the potential for cannabinoid therapy, and by implication, cannabis, for PTSD. There was a study conducted by Canadian scientists not that long after the 9/11 attacks in Lower Manhattan, where the World Trade Center buildings were destroyed. And there were people living in that it's a very crowded neighborhood. And they found 50 people in that area who were, when the attacks happened, about half of the people expressed PTSD. The other half, they handled the situation better. And the scientists did studies on the physiology, on the actual brain chemistry of this entire group, both the PTSD folks and the non-PTSD people. And they found that all the PTSD sufferers had very low levels of endogenous cannabinoids. You know, we produce our own cannabinoids. And they're in the plant, but we also produce endogenous cannabinoids.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, they're very, very important compounds that keep us balanced and healthy. And when you have low levels of these endogenous compounds, it makes you vulnerable for all sorts of diseases. Low levels of endogenous cannabinoids have been linked to alcoholism, to PTSD, to autism in children, to clinical depression. So, you know, there we have a scientific understanding of what would explain why cannabis or cannabinoid therapy would be helpful for both trauma and depression. That's an example, you know, that really underscores that quite vividly, because none of the people that were studied in terms of the World Trade Center experiment research who weren't suffering from PTSD, none of them had these lower levels of endogenous cannabinoids, and they did fine. You know, so that's an example how cannabinoids are important to protect against PTSD. One of the really nice statements that been made by an Italian scientist, actually, Vincenzo Di Marzio, when asked to describe, what does the endocannabinoid system do? You know, what is it responsible for?
Yeah.
And he said, he said five things: eat, sleep, relax, protect, and forget. That it's involved in, you know, regulating your eating, your sleeping, your relaxing. We've already discussed protection, neuroprotection in this conversation. But forgetting, now that's an interesting one, that he would pick that as one of the key five things. And we think, forgetting, that doesn't necessarily sound so good. But if you think about it, forgetting is an essential part of human health, that if we remembered every single thing that happened to us from the moment we got up this morning to the time we go to bed, every single detail, literally we'd be stark raving mad. We have to forget things. That's part of being healthy, to remember what we need to remember, and forget what we don't need to let. Unfortunately, people who suffer from PTSD can't forget things they need to forget. They can't let go of these traumatic memories. And it's the endocannabinoid system that regulates memory and forgetting. So you need a healthy endocannabinoid system, which can be supported by cannabis and many other things like exercise, good sleep, good diet, to keep our bodies, our minds healthy.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned that on Project CBD, you published a good amount of research. And can we ask you for which specific treatment is cannabis being investigated?
Cannabis is investigated for quite a few different treatments at this point.
Yeah.
Keep in mind that the research world, when it comes to cannabis, is strangely bifurcated. It's split. You have a lot of historical research, historical records. We have a lot of scientific studies, literally tens of thousands of studies have been conducted involving cannabis or cannabinoids. So I could tell you all about what cannabis does to a mouse. But there's been also a lot of anecdotal reports, particularly since medical cannabis has been legalized in California in 1996, in other states in the U.S. and in other countries now.
Yeah.
We're getting increasingly reports from people who are saying, this is how it helps me, or this doesn't help me. So we have a lot of preclinical research. We have a lot of anecdotal reports from people. What's missing largely is the clinical research that could, quote unquote, prove that it works.
Yeah.
You know, we have, for the medical establishment requires, it goes through a certain kind of testing. It's the gold standard, double-blind, randomized controlled trials, et cetera, et cetera. And you can get very important information from that kind of experimentation. But frankly, I don't think necessarily that's the optimal way to judge the effectiveness of cannabis, because it's like trying to fit a square into a round peg. You know, again, the gold standard, randomized, double-blind, they can give you important information about efficacy, but
yeah.
I'm not sure it's the best lens through which to see how cannabis works. I can tell you in terms of CBD-rich cannabis, and by that I mean cannabis that includes a significant amount of both CBD and THC, that what we hear from people at Project CBD, what they're having success using a CBD-rich cannabis for, it's really three areas: pain, depression, and anxiety, particularly anxiety. When it comes to anxiety, CBD almost seems like a killer app. It really, really helpful for anxiety. And that speaks to, you know, the difficulties of the moment in the modern world. There's so much anxiety, not just because of the pandemic, but so many different ways that people are exposed to stimuli and experiences that make you anxious. And CBD in particular could be quite good for that. THC as well could be very relaxing. But with THC, and you asked about the differences between CBD and THC. THC does induce a kind of a mild euphoria. But for some people, that could be dysphoria. It could be unpleasant.
Yeah.
CBD doesn't induce either dysphoria or euphoria. It doesn't have that kind of effect. I wouldn't say that CBD is not psychoactive. It is, because it can affect one's mood. It can lift one's depression. It can ease one's anxiety. And if a compound could do that, clearly it's psychoactive. But what CBD is not is intoxicating in the sense that THC could be. And the interaction is very, very important between CBD and THC. You know, cannabis has been referred to by Raphael Mishulam, the great Israeli scientist, who's done so much important research. He's referred to cannabis as a medicinal treasure trove. It has a lot of compounds in it, and you can think of CBD and THC is the kind of like the crown jewels of that treasure trove. They work best together.
Yeah.
It might sound odd to say it, but THC actually makes CBD safer.
Right.
And people might think that that's a real head scratcher, because CBD is very safe. It doesn't get you high. It has, but where you can get in trouble with CBD is taking high doses and combining those with pharmaceuticals. CBD interacts with a lot of different pharmaceuticals. A majority of approved pharmaceuticals CBD will interact with. And that sometimes can be dangerous. Actually, it can also be helpful in some situations.
Yeah.
But when you combine THC with CBD, it lower even a little amount of THC, it lowers the amount of CBD necessary to have the therapeutic effect you're looking for. If you're taking less CBD, less likelihood of problematic interactions. And also you can reverse it and say CBD makes THC safer.
Yeah.
I mean, generally speaking, people have limits with THC. It sort of has its own guardrails. You know when you've had too much. If you've eaten an edible and you get too high, you know you've overdone it a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or maybe even a lot. So, you know, I mean, 10 milligrams of THC is a healthy dose for a normal, or for most people. You know, 20 milligrams, it could be a nice dose for a stoner. But when you're talking about CBD, you're talking about people taking 500 milligrams, 1,000 milligrams. So the drug interactions with THC are less likely because you're taking much smaller doses. But what the interesting thing that scientists have found is that when they are doing research, this is an example of research on animals, looking at gut disorders, colitis and Crohn's, diseases like that.
Yeah.
And they found when they give a mouse that has colitis a subclinical dose of THC, meaning a very small dose, it doesn't do enough to help the mouse in terms of the experiment. But when they combine it with CBD, that subclinical dose becomes a therapeutic dose of THC, and THC happens to be very effective potentially for gut disorders. The problem is, if you need, for some people, it can easily be too much THC, or the amount that you'd need for a therapeutic effect gets you too high.
Yeah.
But if you combine it with CBD, it lowers the amount of THC needed, so you don't have to get too high. So they really work together. We call them the power couple of cannabis therapeutics, CBD and THC.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, moving on to another question. Can we physically notice if we are developing neuronal atrophy or depression because of cannabis?
You know, it's not likely one would develop neuronal atrophy from using cannabis. It would actually be likely that one would experiencing neuronal atrophy, meaning, again, it's a slowdown of the neurogenesis process that you're getting older. The brain is not producing new brain cells, new stem cells in the way it needs to. That's neuronal atrophy. And as a result, you know, again, it's associated with clinical depression. One is feeling depressed, one may be more likely to reach for cannabis to elevate one's mood, to get out of depression.
Yeah.
And that can easily be misinterpreted. Oh, see, that person's neuronal atrophy and they're using cannabis. Cannabis is causing it. It's just the opposite. It's sort of like the amotivational syndrome. I would call it a myth that's been sort of the holdover from reefer madness, the charges leveled against cannabis. Oh, it makes people couch potatoes. You sit around, you're a young person, it demotivates you. You're not going to do well in school and so forth. The likelihood is if you're already amotivated, you're likely to reach for cannabis. And it might keep you there. It might not motivate you, but it's not what's causing the amotivation. It's just the opposite. And there's a lot of things like that, that it's a sort of a reverse causality. I would say the same for allegations that cannabis causes schizophrenia.
Yeah.
You know, schizophrenia usually occurs with young people in their 20s is when a full-blown schizophrenia would emerge. But there's a period before the full expression of schizophrenia is evident. It's called a sort of the prodromal period, where there's might be a few years where a person isn't obviously schizophrenic, but they're sliding toward there.
Yeah.
They don't have all the symptoms. But that prodromal phase could be very anxiety-ridden. It's a type of experience that will make one more likely to want to use cannabis to kind of ease one's stress.
Yeah.
And people can then interpret that as, oh, see, that person's smoking a lot of weed now. And look, now they become schizophrenic. See what the weed did. No, it's just the opposite.
Absolutely.
Because they were already becoming schizophrenic. You see, and I don't want to make light of these things. You know, we're talking about difficult situations where someone you might say is abusing cannabis, smoking from a young person, smoking morning till night, and and you know, their social interactions are suffering, their school is suffering, and you know, this is a real situation. But is the problem cannabis, or are there other problems which the cannabis is sort of shielding or hiding because that's what a person seeks to you know, to comfort themselves? I think there might be better ways for that person to get out of a rut. You know, exercising regularly, for example, would be one. And exercise, as I mentioned before, exercise actually stimulates neurogenesis. Eating certain kinds of food stimulates neurogenesis. So it's not just these cannabinoids that do that, or psychedelic drugs, for that matter, which also stimulate neurogenesis. So, you know, we have to look at these things carefully. We shouldn't make light of the fact when someone's going through difficulties and whether they're using cannabis or not. It's just important not to confuse the issue and scapegoat cannabis when there's really other issues at play when someone might be having a quote-unquote cannabis use disorder, which is a phrase I don't use very often because I think it's one of these sort of medical phrases that have been concocted to describe a set of behaviors that isn't necessarily caused by cannabis is the issue.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that things like Project CBD are extremely helpful to our cause because they give access to a lot of the information in one singular place, and it's harder to kind of get misinformation once you see them all in the same platform. So I think that's really important, the point you just made. This is actually a question from our audience. We always go and ask before a podcast in case, and we always have really, really interesting questions. So this is from them, and it's, what are the main risks of cannabis exposure in early life?
Well, I think, again, this is an area where fears about exposing a young person or before they're 25 years old to cannabis. That's a bad idea because the brain is developing still. The brain is always developing. The brain doesn't stop developing when you're 25 years old.
Yeah.
You don't stop neurogenesis when you're 25 years old. You know, it slows down the process as you age. But so I don't want to be... you know, we don't go recommend people use cannabis when they're young. That's up to a young person. You know, I mean, people when they're teenagers, they experience stress. Cannabis is very useful for stress.
Yeah.
It can help you deal with stress. It happens to be very safe as a medication, if you will. The problem is more the law, if anything else. That said, there are some downsides to using cannabis, as there is for anything. I don't think the danger is that one will develop schizophrenia because one smokes cannabis, or one's brain will start to rot because you're using cannabis. But there are some very simple things. You know, first, if you use cannabis regularly, keep in mind that it is an herb.
Yeah.
And herbs can be what's referred to as astringent, meaning some herbs dry the body, some herbs moisten the body, some herbs heat the body, some herbs cool the body. Well, cannabis dries the body. You might know that when you smoke, you realize, hey, you're feeling like you want to drink some water or something. Your mouth gets really dry. And that happens even if you don't smoke it, if you take an edible. It's astringent. So if you're going to use cannabis on a regular basis, be sure to hydrate well. That's one thing. The other thing is cannabis has an effect of slightly lowering one's blood pressure. Now, in a society like we live in, you know, really high-paced industrial societies, if anything, if people having a problem with blood pressure, it's because blood pressure is too high. Yeah. So cannabis, in that sense, is very helpful. But some people have the opposite issue. Their blood pressure tends to be kind of low. Or lower than normal. Well, if you use a substance that lowers blood pressure and you already are dealing with low blood pressure, you know, the odds are you probably won't like the experience very much. You know, some people try it, they don't like it. That might be the case. But one has to be aware of those kinds of things. This is a serious, this is a complex herb. It has many different physiological effects. And we can't assume always it's going to be affect us in a way that's positive. So those are just two examples in terms of low blood pressure and the need to hydrate that one should be aware of it. But the idea that it's going to hurt a person's brain, no. Will it help a person's brain in the sense if one's in kind of an emotional rut? It doesn't mean the cannabis will get you out of it.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can kind of keep you in it. Sometimes you need to let it go and give it a rest or not use it. You know, there's a saying, there's kind of a meme that goes around, I'm in a relationship with a plant, referring to cannabis.
Yeah.
I've always liked that because I think the model of relationships aren't static. You start a relationship. If it's a sexual relationship, it's really exciting, you know, and then it kind of eases into another kind of, or morphs into a different kind of relationship. Or if it's a long-term marriage, it has other rewards and riches, you know, involved with it. But things are changing and you're adjusting and you relate to your partner. You know, you're always checking what's going on and how things are going. Well, in a sense, you should relate the same way to cannabis. I'm not saying it should be a substitute for romantic relationships or friendships. No. If anything, cannabis could help to build relationships. It's a community building botanical. But, you know, one should adjust. One should think about what's going on. Well, maybe you are doing too much. Maybe you're experiencing a little bit of, you know, it's not working for you as well as it was in the past.
Yeah.
You're not getting high in the same way. So you know, threat tolerance and so forth. Well, take a little break. Maybe sometimes just like you have to take a little break in a relationship, you might maybe take a little break for a couple of days for cannabis. Don't use it for a couple of days. You know, press the reset button. Dr. Dustin Sulak talks about this, the need to sensitize oneself to cannabis sometimes if you're a chronic user. And we're not judging that it's a bad or good thing to be a regular or a chronic user of cannabis. Many people are, but sometimes you do need a little break and that will actually enhance the experience when you go back to it. Or if you're using high THC cannabis with very little CBD, try a strain that's sort of mixed both CBD and THC and might be very pleasantly surprised. When you mix CBD and THC together, it will change the experience a little bit. What it does, CBD will lower the ceiling on the THC high. You don't get quite as high, but it also lengthens the duration of the experience.
Yeah.
So you're high for longer. So you can kind of play around with that, explore that. It's another aspect of the relationship with the plant, you know. In that sense, it's not static. It's not one thing. And we don't make light of people's difficulties in life. And if they're having a difficult time, they might also have a difficult time with cannabis.
Yeah.
It differs from person to person.
Absolutely. Martin, if we have time, I'd like to pick your brain for one last question.
Certainly.
And that is, how can we incorporate medical cannabis into our lives if we never consumed it before?
Well, you know, I think that's one of the gifts of CBD.
Yeah.
That it is an easy door to walk through if you're just entering the cannabis world. For a long time, for many reasons, in part because of the stigma associated with cannabis, going back to the reefer madness days.
Yeah.
A lot of people wouldn't ever had a thought to use it. But yet, you know, they hear about this kind of a buzz in the culture that cannabis has medical uses. Maybe you don't know a lot about it. You hear about it, but no, not for me. I would never smoke marijuana. Well, these days, with CBD and with the different oil extracts and so forth, you can consume cannabis for a therapeutic purpose or for any purpose for that matter without getting high and without even smoking it.
Yeah.
You can get the benefits, the medical benefits, without getting high, without getting very high, and you don't have to smoke it. And the high factor really is influenced by the ratio of CBD and THC. CBD is not intoxicating, and it also can neutralize the intoxicating effects of THC, depending how much of each is in a given product or in a given cannabis varietal or strain. If there's an equal amount of both, you will get high from it. Trust me on that. And that's typically how cannabis used to be, equal amounts of CBD and THC.
Yeah.
But because of the breeding and so forth and prohibition, the horticulturists developed strains, wonderful strains of cannabis with very high in THC, very low in CBD. That gets you really high. A lot of people enjoy these strains. I personally do as well. But that's one shouldn't necessarily forego the opportunity, if you have it, to try things with CBD and with more CBD in it. You can really get some nice effects. And for a newcomer to the cannabis scene, CBD is a really good entry point to get a product with this high CBD, very low THC. I'd always recommend some THC in there. Yeah. Rather than a CBD isolate, because it will work better. But you won't get high from it, or it's very, very unlikely that you'll experience any kind of a stoniness or intoxication from a very high CBD, low THC plant.
Yeah.
It's almost like a hemp plant or something like that. So I think that's a good way to go, because and if you're going to start, the saying goes, start low, go slow.
Yeah,
start
exactly.
With a low
yeah.
dose.
Yeah.
And increase slowly, but there's another part of that saying it's start low, go slow, but don't be afraid to go all the way, you know, because sometimes you need more to get the effects you're looking for.
Yeah.
And some people might be thinking, oh, well, they don't want to get high, you know, all that stuff. But when they start experimenting, they do get a little high and they realize, hey, this is nice. They like this. So
yeah.
CBD could be your gateway to THC, and that would be fine if that's the case, because it's not harmful. It can be very, very helpful, and the high part of it can also have intrinsic therapeutic value.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Martin. You opened us a world for us today. You have so much knowledge, so I do thank you for taking the time to come in on here today with us, and make sure all our listeners to check out Project CBD, and we hope you have a nice day and to hear from you soon back on our podcast.
It's been a pleasure and nice to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Bye, Martin.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You can find all the other interviews on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. You can also find us on all social media at Royal Queen Seed RQS. We will see you next time.
Royal Queen Seeds Interviews.